This podcast is brought to you by Langley & Binnack, a full-service South and Central Texas law firm that delivers the highest quality legal advice coupled with exceptional client service. From our main office in San Antonio, we provide the resources of a national firm while maintaining close ties to the communities in which we practice. To learn more, please visit us at langleybinnack.com. That's langleybinnack.com or call us at 210-736-6600.
I'm Clinton Butler, and I'd like to welcome you all to our three-part series on corporate, real estate, and banking law in Texas.
The information, opinions, and recommendations presented in the Langley & Binnack podcast are for information purposes only and should not be considered legal or professional advice for any particular situation. The presentation of this informational content does not create an attorney-client relationship. If you would like to meet with one of our attorneys, please contact us through our website at www.langleybinnack.com or call us at 210-736-6600.
For those of you that are new to the Langley & Binnack podcast network, allow me to introduce myself. My name is Clinton Butler. I am a shareholder with the law firm of Langley & Binnack. I work in both the San Antonio and the Carnes City offices. The main focus of my practice is oil and gas and commercial litigation. I've been doing oil and gas and energy law since I left the Travis County DA's office back in 2010 as kind of offshoots from that area of law that I concentrated in. I also do a lot of litigation in the commercial context and fiduciary law. But today I am joined by my partner at Langley & Binnack, Mark Schnall, who has the unique distinction of anybody at Langley & Binnack of having known me since I was about 9 years old. Mark was a partner of my father's at the law firm of Soles & Wallace before Soles & Wallace joined up with Langley. And I've known Mark basically since I've moved to San Antonio. So Mark and I have gone from Mark having to deal with a snot-nosed 12-year-old to now him and I being equity partners together in a law firm. But Mark, it's a pleasure to have you here. I think anybody that knows me knows that I think extremely highly of Mark. And I think that not only is he one of the brightest lawyers in his area of law, but he's also just a really good guy. So I'm really looking forward to our conversation today. Mark, good afternoon. Please tell us a little bit about yourself.
Thanks, Clinton. I appreciate all those kind words. As you say, I'm a shareholder with Langley & Binnack. I am co-chair of our real estate section, and I'm a member of the firm's management committee and its executive committee. I've been practicing real estate law for almost 50 years, first with a nonprofit and then with private law firms. I'm board certified by the Texas Board of Legal Specialization in both residential real estate law and commercial real estate law. I got those certifications the first 2 years that certifications were made available in this specialty. Very experienced in all kinds of real estate transactions.
And what are those certifications? What do those entail? What do you have to do to become board certified?
To be qualified to apply for a board certification, you have to have practiced in the area of law, in the case of real estate, for at least 5 years. And you have to submit a detailed application that itemizes the extent of your real estate law experience by subspecialty. So both for the residential and the commercial, I had to identify matters that I had handled, lawyers who I had been up against in real estate matters involving residential real estate in one case and commercial real estate in the other. And then there is a roughly 6-hour written examination. The first 3 hours are just general real estate law, and the other 3 hours were directed specifically to in the real estate area, real estate law questions, and in the commercial real estate type questions. As I said, I was in the first group to take that exam in 1983 in the real estate area, and then in the second group to take it in 1984 in the commercial area. It does require both experience as well as taking a test. I told myself I would never take another test after taking the bar exam, but lo and behold, I've taken several more.
I was true to that promise when I made it. And I have made sure that I maintain my no homework policy since leaving law school. But, you know, Mark, one thing that is fascinating is every lawyer has their own journey as to how they got into this particular business. You know, mine involves a very, you know, respected litigator father, a bomb scare, and an unexplained or an unexpected pregnancy is how I got into oil and gas law. But, you know, it's always, you know, fun to hear how somebody got into the area that they got into. How did you find yourself in residential and commercial real estate?
Well, I have to tell you, it didn't involve a pregnancy.
I will say that I probably got one of the more unique journeys, but, you know, everybody's got their own.
Well, I'm sad to say my answer is not as exciting as yours. When I worked for that that nonprofit organization, the executive director was looking for someone to tackle a specific area, specifically the real estate area of law. We didn't have anyone doing that. And so, you know, I jumped in to do that. My brother thinks I'm a real estate lawyer because my mother was a real estate agent for over 50 years in another state. And he blames that as my heritage to become a real estate lawyer. But it really was maybe a little bit of fate that I would start in that area at the nonprofit and then use that experience to become board certified and to become recognized as a real estate lawyer of note. I've been recognized as a best lawyer in America by the Best Lawyers Organization in real estate since 2010. And in 2013, I was named the San Antonio Best Lawyers Real Estate Lawyer for the San Antonio region. I've also been recognized as a Texas Super Lawyer on four or five occasions. And since the Scene in San Antonio magazine did its Best Lawyers recognition 20 or so years ago, I've been named in the real estate section as a Best Lawyer in San Antonio by that publication virtually every year.
So I want to introduce our audience to Katie Corrigan, who is our marketing director, who I'm sure probably had to spend about 4 hours in your office yesterday convincing you to talk about your credentials. Because Mark is not one who likes to talk about, you know, what a high quality lawyer he is. But I'm glad that you gave the audience all of your accomplishments. It's an impressive resume that you have. What is it about real estate law that's kept you in it? You know, you must have found something in the area of real estate that really, you know, really got to you. What is it that, you know, you really enjoy about this area of the law?
Well, most residential real estate transactions and most commercial real estate transactions have some similarities. But what keeps me interested is the things about each transaction which are not similar to other transactions. So it's the variance of what I do on a daily basis, where I might be talking to a landlord about a tenant who's not paying rent in the morning, and I might be talking to a tenant that same afternoon about changes we'd like to make to a lease being proposed by a different landlord. It might be talking to a property seller about getting exactly the right terms in a contract. And then later that day, talking to a buyer who wants to know, why hasn't the seller signed the contract that we sent 3 days ago? So it's what's different. is what keeps things interesting. I say to some folks that one of the things that keeps me really interested in doing what I do and continuing to do it is when I drive into the office in the morning, and I'm still driving into the office in the morning, I know about half of what I'm going to do. And the other half is really controlled by emails and phone calls, you know, other kinds of contact from clients about problems that have arisen since the last time they talked to me.
You see what the email tide has brought in for that day.
It is definitely a tide and sometimes a tsunami.
Sometimes it's a much larger wave than what we'd like. But now is the portion of our podcast. This is the war story time, because all lawyers love to hear war stories. All lawyers love to tell war stories. So give me a crazy situation and give me the real estate deal that if you had to hang that one on the wall and say that's the one that Mark Schnall is most proud of. So give me your craziest one and give me the one that you're most proud of.
I don't know if I can exactly do that, but I will tell you the two or three transactions that stick out to me when a question like this comes up. One is I actually helped a city once sell its old city hall and buy a new city hall, which is a pretty unusual situation, because in addition to the real estate work that I do, I'm also city attorney for right now three suburbs of San Antonio. And at one point, you know, was representing five or six different cities at various points in my career.
What suburbs are those?
The current list of suburbs I represent are Castle Hills, Hill Country Village, and Selma. In the past, I've represented Almos Park and Kirby and Seguin and Converse, done some work for Eagle Pass as well, where we have a satellite office. So that practice is pretty varied. But buying and selling City Hall is not something most lawyers can put on their resume. The other one that sticks out in my mind is I had a client who inherited from her parents the landlord under a 99-year ground lease on some property in Dallas. When that lease was signed, the property was vacant land, sort of near downtown Dallas, but vacant land with nothing going on around it. When I was involved with my client, that vacant land had become the parking garage for one of the 50-plus story office buildings in downtown Dallas. And so the project that stands out is a combination of first, you know, doing the negotiation to reset the rent under that lease, and then to negotiate the office building owners buying out the ground lease, because they were uncomfortable with the ground lease at some point expiring or some other things happening that would make it easier for them to market that office building if they control the parking garage as well. So when you enter into a lease for vacant land, you ought to do that on property that is going to be next door to an office building.
So, you know, now is the part of the show, we like to call this the dinner party part of the show, where, you know, whenever lawyers are at a dinner party and they introduce themselves, oh, I'm a lawyer, immediately they get the litany of questions from, oh, really, and sometimes people ask me like questions about tax and, you know, trust and stuff. And I look at them blankly and I say, you're speaking Greek to me. But, you know, what common questions do you get? You know, what are the dinner party questions that you get most commonly as a real estate attorney?
I think the ones that are most common are first, from the commercial perspective, folks ask me, well, what's involved in selling a piece of commercial real estate property? And so, you know, that is a question that seems short, but there's a long list of things that go into how you sell or buy a piece of commercial real estate. So if I'm representing a seller, you know, we talk about answering that question for someone who wants to sell, I say, well, you need to have a market analysis done or get an appraisal so you don't underprice or overprice your property. Because if your goal is to sell it, you need to have a marketable price, a price that's comparable to real value, or else it's going to be on the market a lot longer than you want. And you also have to figure out, you know, once you get that market analysis done or even an appraisal, you need to interview potential agents or brokers and make sure that you pick an agent or broker who you have confidence in, who you feel has the competency and the experience and the motivation to help you market the property effectively.
How important is the agent broker relationship in selling a piece of property?
I think it's very important to have a broker who thinks like you do and who respects your opinion. The broker needs to remember that he or she is an agent, and he or she is there to work with you to get your property sold. Agents can provide a lot of information and give a lot of advice. Ultimately, they need to remember that the client makes the calls. The client makes the decisions. And so when you do these interviews, you want to be sure that the agent is knowledgeable and will give you information and give you advice, but also respects the fact that you're the client. You're the one who's ultimately going to see that they get paid a commission at closing. And you want to make sure that you have a good working relationship.
Do you develop a relationship with these agent and brokers as the deal goes on, or are you kind of siloed in one area and the agent and broker are siloed in another?
It varies from deal to deal, in part depending on whether the client already had a pre-existing arrangement with the broker or not. But I do like to keep brokers informed because that's something valuable. And I often tell my clients, have your broker do this, because if I do it, I have to charge you. And your broker is going to already get paid through his commission. So if it's something that doesn't have any significant legal ramification and it's in the broker's wheelhouse, you know, I suggest to the client, let's have the broker take care of arranging this or getting that, because it's cost effective for the client.
You know, my wife just became a real estate agent herself. And, you know, it's amazing how much law, you know, those real estate agents have to learn in the process of getting their real estate license.
I agree. And sometimes a little knowledge of the law is a dangerous thing.
Very dangerous. Oftentimes I have to walk her back from visit, like, well, sweetheart, we're not considering X, Y, or Z either. But, you know, I think that, you know, certainly on, and I imagine this is your advice, any major transaction, it helps to have a lawyer involved as well.
Absolutely. And one of the other things I do tell my clients when they're shopping for a broker is to let me see the broker's listing agreement before they sign it. Because I do want to make sure about two or three things that are either in or not in that listing agreement. And I can tell right away when I look at a listing agreement how the broker suggests marketing the property in terms of what kinds of offers to look for. I can pretty much quickly tell whether this is a broker who knows what they're doing or a broker that is not as experienced as they ought to be, but we work through it. Again, you know, our job, both the broker and the lawyer's job, is the same. Get the property sold, get the client's plan implemented. So we try to work together. It's very counterproductive if the lawyer and the broker aren't on the same page.
What other questions do you get at the dinner party?
The question I get now more than before is, why does it take so long to get a deal closed? And the answer to that question is, it's really a function of the marketplace. And that primarily, a significant part is due to all the extra steps that have to be taken to satisfy various timing requirements. COVID didn't help, but in a real estate transaction where there is a loan from a third-party lender, everything takes longer because the title work by the title company takes longer. The lender has multiple hoops for the borrower buyer to go through. It is invariably common for the closing documents to be provided one day before closing, if not on the day of closing, which makes it really difficult when you're representing or when I'm representing a buyer borrower to be able to go through those loan documents effectively and make sure that they're consistent with the deal the client thought he or she had made with the lender and don't have any odd or non-standard provisions that would need to be explained to the client. I don't tell a client, this promissory note says you got to pay, make this payment for this period of time at this interest rate. I figure the client has seen that and knows that's what, and we've all confirmed that's the deal. But I do want to tell the client, if there's a clause in that promissory note that is not something I see in most promissory notes, and make sure that the client is alerted to that. And then we determine whether we need to go back to the lender and say, wait a minute, this won't work for me. And then negotiate some kind of alternative middle ground or just convince the lender that it's unnecessary and take it out. So that question, though, is the one that comes up, is why does it take so long? And there are a lot of players in a real estate transaction, and some of them clients don't realize. I mean, they know about the buyer and the seller, and they know about the brokers. Most people know about the title company, but clients aren't really always that in tune with, oh, we have to get a survey, or, oh, the buyer needs more time to have an inspection done, and things like that. Each one of those steps can add days or even weeks to a real estate transaction. And so it's like I said earlier about, you know, the variety of what I do. Each deal is a little different and each deal has the same kinds of delays. But in each case, you know, the delay from the surveyor might be short, but the delay from the inspector might be long and vice versa.
From your perspective, are we in a buyer or seller's market right now?
I think it's more balanced. We went through a period right when, shortly after COVID started in the spring of 2020, where a piece of residential real estate would go on the market on Friday, and Monday the seller would have five offers, most of them above the asking price. And properties got put under contract incredibly quickly, and sellers were getting super top dollar. And we considered that to be a seller's market.
What was causing that eruption in sales?
Great question. If I had a crystal ball, I could tell you. I think we all saw that to one degree or another. You know, walking around our neighborhood, we would see a for sale sign on Thursday night and a sold sign on Sunday or Monday.
Yeah.
And it was amazing. And I learned through my practice that a lot of those sales were at above the original asking price. And some of my seller clients told me that in addition to get offers above their asking price, they got letters from these prospective buyers begging to buy the house. You know, my daughter, who's 10, loved that room. She really wanted that to be her room. It was amazing. I think there might have been some worry and hysteria about the future. And you know, COVID changed everybody's lives almost literally overnight. But it turned into a bonanza for sellers. That lasted 18 to 20 months. And at the beginning of 2023, midway through 2022, but more at the beginning of 2023, it began to change. And just like COVID changed everything overnight, this seller's market seemed to almost change overnight as a function of the change in the interest rate environment and lenders tightening up the kinds of things they needed in order to give loans.
The Fed has raised the interest rates about a half point, correct?
Right. The Federal Reserve raised the federal rate, and that had a ripple effect on mortgage rates, so that mortgage rates, which were the lowest I'd ever seen in 2021 and in most of 2022, began to track upward as the Federal Reserve Board raised the federal rate that banks use. And I think that is the primary reason why the seller's market is over. I view the market now as fairly balanced. I don't think it's a buyer's market, but properties are staying on the market longer. Properties are not always selling above asking price. I think the selling price is still strong. The selling dollar is still strong. In many other areas, cash is king. A cash buyer who doesn't need a transaction to be delayed by going through a whole bunch of lender hoops is going to be a more attractive offer than a offer at even a little bit higher price if it's contingent upon getting loan approval or if it's contingent upon selling an existing home. When this whole seller's market was going on, sellers didn't worry about whether the buyer had to sell their own home because they were confident that the buyer would have the same luck and the same speed of selling their current home as the seller had and getting this offer from these folks to buy the seller's home. Now, contingencies are back the way they were 5 years ago, where a sophisticated seller will think, well, you know, this cash offer is $5,000 less than this offer that's contingent upon the buyer getting financing, or $5,000 less than the buyer getting a buyer for their house. And I'm going to take the cash offer. And most brokers, before they'll present a cash offer, get some kind of written pre-authorization or evidence of the availability of the cash needed to buy. And so we would always, in those situations, before a client would make that decision, we would ask the broker for the buyer to provide evidence that the buyer does have the cash to close. And if the answer was yes, most of my clients were willing to take a few thousand dollars less in order to not have to be concerned about the uncertainties of a lender or the uncertainties of the buyer being able to sell their current home.
I don't do near as much real estate as you do, but in the times I've done transactions, I've always counseled my buyers, get a letter of pre-approval first, because it puts you in that position where you're able to tell the seller, I've got the cash on hand. I can put velocity on this. We don't have to worry about me going through an approval process. You know, I've already taken a lot of steps before I even got here to make the offer. And, you know, I've always found that sellers take buyers with pre-approval letters much more seriously than they do those without.
Absolutely correct. Even though most of those letters have small print at the bottom of them that say, you know, subject to this or subject to that, having that letter is very, very valuable. It certainly puts that buyer significantly ahead of a buyer who doesn't have it.
At the very least, it lets the seller know that you're serious. You know, you're not just there looking at somebody's house. You know, you're there to make a deal. You have gone through, you know, the back-breaking process of trying to get loan approval. You know, you're ready to go. And that shows a level of commitment to the seller that you know, they want to see out of their buyer.
That's right. And the other thing that helps in conjunction with that is putting down a little bit larger earnest money deposit than is typical. That combination will tell a seller, yes, I'm qualified, I can get the loan, and I'm evidencing my real interest in your house by, instead of putting down 1% as earnest money, I'm going to put down more than that. And although that earnest money can be refundable for a short period of time, again, it's a signal to the seller, this is a serious buyer who's more likely than not to close.
That's right. I want the damn house. Yeah. Is there any area that you see on the horizon, like water rights or, air rights or something like that, that you see drastically changing in the real estate field in the future? Like, for example, in my world, in oil and gas, the area of executive right law, the ability to negotiate, draft, and sign the oil and gas lease has flipped on its head in the last, 12 years. Is there an area that is currently flipping or that you see flipping in the near future that could cause some big changes in the real estate law world?
It's just too unpredictable. We thought in the, I'd say 20 years ago, I was hearing water is the new oil in Texas, but we still have, we still produce more oil and gas than any other state. You can correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure that's a safe.
Oil is still oil in Texas.
Yeah. Okay. And our legislature is encouraging and protecting the oil and gas industry. If we were a different kind of state, I would say that the one thing that could change and may change in other jurisdictions, I just don't see it changing that much in Texas, is the renewable energy area, the solar energy and the wind energy. There are wind farms. I've seen the turbines in West Texas, near Fort Stockton in particular. There was a lot of interest in developing new solar projects. I negotiated for clients in Wilson County for a solar field on a couple hundred acres. Those deals dried up, I think, as a function of this interest rate problem we talked about a few minutes ago.
Yeah, money's not free.
Yeah, money's not free. And so the solar companies have kind of backed away, and my clients are willing to wait. So, in a different environment, we might see more activity in the solar and wind energy areas. But I think Texas will, as long as there's production, Texas will be a big producer of oil and gas, which is why when you go to the filling station now, we're paying less per gallon than they are in California and on the East Coast and virtually everywhere in the country. We have the lowest fuel prices, so not complaining about that. But from a real estate law standpoint, I don't see anything else that is likely to be a dramatic change. And water, as it turns out, and as you know, and many of our listeners may know, water is something that you use a lot of when you're producing oil and gas.
An amazing amount of water.
I've done leases for clients where they have leased water to oil and gas companies. So, water is still a very valuable commodity, and I wish we could get more from the sky.
Wouldn't that be nice? What I'm finding with regards to renewables in the oil and gas industry is I'm finding a burgeoning sense of cooperation between new and old forms of energy where, solar powered panels are being used to power pump jacks. That they're using renewables in an effort to assist in the production of oil and gas. And to me, that's the right way to bridge those two energy sources. I don't think anybody reasonably believes you could cold turkey oil and gas, but at the same time, just like coal was a 19th century form of energy, oil and gas is going to someday be considered a 20th and early 21st century form of energy. I think that by the time my grandkids are having kids, I don't know if oil and gas would be the dominant form of energy anymore. And, you know, I think that investment needs to be made into those new forms because, you know, other countries are investing very heavily in them and it's coming. But at the same time, you know, we certainly like to keep ourselves at the top of the heap with regards to the dominant form of energy that exists today, which is oil and gas. So I think if those two industries can learn to cooperate for the next 30 to 50 years, which is what I anticipate being the bridge time, you know, I think that will help both industries. And so that's something that we're seeing down in South Texas. You know, we've got some wind and solar farms down here that are acting in conjunction with oil and gas development. So that's promising.
No, that's great. And, you know, oil and gas is considered a depleting industry in a sense, because, mm-hmm. you know, they eventually, you know, these plays play out and the production reduces. What we say about real estate is they're not making any more dirt.
That's right.
So that's why land has been historically considered a safe investment. You know, when the whole Eagle Ford play became active, and a lot of farmers in places like Karnes County, where, you know, you have an office, and in other parts of South Texas, when they would, you know, sign oil and gas leases and receive royalty payments, what do they do with that money? They'd buy land. They'd buy land because they understood land. They worked the land. And so I've represented, you know, a half a dozen or more people who made a lot of money from oil and gas royalties and put that money into buying other real estate.
I think that just about every single one of my major oil and gas clients has used some portion of their royalty and or bonus money to buy land that is not subject to oil and gas development. And so, including the guy who shares my last name. And so your former partner did exactly that. And he said the exact same thing you did, which is, you know, I come from a family of ranchers. I've, you know, been around real estate and worked land my entire life. That he knows that. He doesn't know the New York Stock Exchange. And so he knows that, you know, if I stash my money in a, you know, good piece of land in an area that's growing, that's going to increase in value. And, you know, that'll be, you know, a nest egg if I need it. And so that lots of people in the Eagle Ford and in West Texas who, you know, the thing they are familiar with is dirt and, you know, water and, you know, grass. They choose to invest in what you know. And I think that's always a really good investment strategy.
Right. Know what you're getting yourself into.
So Mark, you know, when you are not practicing law, you know, what are your hobbies? What do you like to do? You know, first of all, tell us about your wonderful family, and then tell us what you like to do in your free time.
Well, my wife is semi-retired. She first worked for the state of Texas for over 28 years. Then she went into private consulting, retired three times, and this time it's sort of stuck. But now she spends a lot of time giving tours and volunteering at the Tobin Center for the Performing Arts. We have three children. My son lives in Colorado and is a senior counsel for a renewable energy company based in London, England. My daughter, his twin sister, is an attorney with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission in Washington, D.C. And our younger son works in the education field in St. Louis. We have four grandchildren, and we try and see them as often as we can. Last night, one of our grandchildren called while dinner was being made. And suffice it to say that we ate dinner late last night.
Priority over every single thing in the world.
Yeah. And for free time activities, I spent a lot of time doing volunteer work, serving on boards of various nonprofit organizations. I'm a past president of a United Way agency, past president of a 500 plus member, a religious a congregation. I'm vice chairman of a large religious nonprofit in San Antonio, and chair its planning and allocations work and its grants distribution work, lead committees that generally allocate or distribute anywhere from $500,000 to $700,000 per year to various organizations and charitable beneficiaries. I spent 6 years on the board of the Keystone School, including 4 years as treasurer. So that's a lot of what I do in my spare time.
So in other words, in Mark's free time, when he's not working, he works.
Essentially, that's what I have been accused of that by other people.
I'm sure your wife is probably one of those people.
I should mention that I was on a local zoning commission for roughly 25 years, about half of that time as the chairman of that commission. And then after retiring from the chairmanship of the commission, was the chairman of the zoning review committee for that city on two separate occasions. So I still have my hand deeply in the zoning ordinance in one of our suburbs.
Well, Mark, it was a real pleasure getting to talk to you today. I always enjoy getting to talk to you, and you know, just this time we happened to record it. But want to thank you very much for joining us today on the podcast. Very informative. I hope people also found it as entertaining as I did. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Clinton, I really appreciate it. And in the next podcast, please explain the story about your oil and gas practice being generated by a pregnancy.
Well, I'll just tell you that we were living in Austin, having a great time. And then we got pregnant and our fun days were coming to a close no matter what. And around that same time, dad was asking me if we wanted to move to Karn City. So me and the girl from Bogota moved to Karn City for a couple of years.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, All right,
Mark, thank you very much. And everybody, this is Clinton Butler, and I want to thank you all for joining us today. On our next episode, we will be discussing corporate law, at which time I'll be joined by Tim Siegfried, who has over 37 years of experience handling complex corporate transactions, including a couple that I've gotten him to do for me. So thank you all for joining us today on Langley Banach's podcast series on corporate, real estate, and banking law in Texas. Until next time, this is Clinton Butler, and I'll see you then. Bye.
Thank you for joining us today for the Langley and Banach podcast. Please subscribe to get the latest updates. If you would like to meet with one of our attorneys, please contact us through our website, www.langleybanach.com, or call us at 210-736-6600.